You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for the week ending June 27th. I'm Joe Elia. We offer a roundup of the week's news along with an interview. This week's is with Jack Hirsch, and it's about the new guidelines for antithrombotic and thrombolytic therapy issued by the American College of Chest Physicians. If you'd like to leave us a comment, and we hope you will, call 617-440-4374. That's 617-440-4374. Story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Okay, here are the week's top medical stories in brief. There are four. One on home monitoring for blood pressure, another on the two-way link between depression and diabetes, another on subtle neurologic abnormalities as predictors of future disability, and a new antithrombotic drug apparently nearing approval. Here we go. Major cardiovascular health organizations are urging adoption of home blood pressure monitoring as a standard practice. Office measurements just don't give the whole picture in hypertension for various reasons. The thinking is that home monitoring would improve adherence to treatment and eliminate white coat hypertension. The call for action appears in the July edition of Hypertension. Next, there seems to be a close relationship between depression and diabetes. In about 5,000 patients with symptoms of depression and no diabetes at baseline, there was a significantly increased relative risk for developing diabetes within 3 years. In another group of about the same size, this time patients with diabetes but no depression at baseline, the risk of developing depression within 3 years was significantly elevated. The article appears in this week's JAMA. Next, subtle neurologic abnormalities that you can find on routine physical exam point to heightened stroke risk. An increase in these abnormalities, there were 15 examined, was a harbinger of faster neurological decline in the following 4 years and a higher risk of death or stroke in the following 8 years. What are some of these abnormalities? Reduced shoulder elevation, for example, or postural instability. Writing in Archives of Internal Medicine, editorialists say that a search for these signs during routine exams, quoting, might add a relatively simple and inexpensive means to identify older adults who are vulnerable to disabilities. Finally, a new oral antithrombotic drug called rivaroxaban did well in a comparison against enoxaparin as a way to reduce thrombotic complications after major orthopedic surgery. The manufacturer's study groups presented their results this week in papers appearing in Lancet and New England Journal. Rates of major bleeding were about the same in the two drugs, and rates of deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary embolism were significantly lower with rivaroxaban. In Journal Watch Oncology and Hematology, David Green says that while efficacy looks good, proof of safety will come from post-marketing surveillance. In this week's interview, Jack Hirsch comments briefly on the drug. Here is this week's Journal Watch interview. Just a few days ago, the American College of Chest Physicians issued the 8th edition of its practice guidelines on antithrombotic and thrombolytic therapy. The guidelines appear in a supplement to the journal Chest and run some 1,000 printed pages in length with over 500 recommendations rated according to the panel's certainty regarding the recommendation's benefit as well as the strength of the evidence behind it. Even with an executive summary, itself running some 40 pages, it's not light reading. We've asked Dr. Jack Hirsch, chair of the guidelines panel, to talk with us about the guidelines and their principal recommendations. Dr. Hirsch is professor emeritus in the Department of Medicine at McMaster and the founding director of the Henderson Research Center, also in Hamilton, Ontario. Welcome, Dr. Hirsch.
Pleasure.
The process of doing all this evaluating must have been overwhelming. Can you tell us a little bit about that process?
This time it was even more overwhelming than other times. As you mentioned, this is the 8th edition, and of course, as information has grown, the supplement has grown. And the process is as follows. There are four chairmen or four editors, and I'm chairman of the editors, and along with the editor of CHEST and an executive committee and various other committees of the American College of Chest Physicians, we select and members of the various panels and the chairperson for the various panels the process has started about 2 years before publication. The panels then meet, the members of the panels meet often just by teleconference. Certain responsibilities assigned to various members of the panels, and they then come up with a draft. Now, while this is going on, the panels also submit to the Evidence Base Center, which is selected by the American College of Chess Physicians, a list of major questions to help the Evidence Base Center in their literature search, and tables are developed in answering these questions. For example, how many randomized trials were performed for such a, for such and such indication? What was the methodologic rigor of these randomized trials? For example, were they blinded? Were they not blinded? What was the size? What were the outcome measures? And then the results. So there are, in the end, for each of the recommendations based on randomized trials, cohort studies, case control studies, before and after studies, tables are drawn up with the results of the literature. Where meta-analyses are possible, meta-analyses are performed. And on the basis of that, there's a narrative for each of the chapters describing the results of the major trials. What we try to do is limit a rehash of the trials that were published in previous journals, just summarize those and restrict the narrative to new information.
It seems like a lot of work, and it seems like you have an auditorium full of people doing it. Is it supported by the American College?
Supported by the American College of Chess Physicians.
Yes.
Now, they get sponsorship support. We don't know who their sponsors are.
Okay. So if there is sponsorship that could be in conflict, you're unaware of any sponsors, and the American College of Chess Physicians protects you from that knowledge.
Yeah. Now,
that's great.
All I know is I don't know of any of the sponsors.
Okay.
Now could I get that information? I'm not sure, but we're hands off from any sponsor.
Okay. And so how many people do you think participated directly? Probably a couple of hundred. In total.
And when we started in 1986, there were about 20.
It's 1,000 pages and available to do all subscribers to Chest get a copy of this?
Yes, they do. And then others can, other people can purchase. And we were getting emails, because I've been identified with these now for 20 years, daily from people for the last, I'd say, 6 months waiting for them to come out. The whole idea is that this is, and I use this a lot, and the whole idea is that this is an encyclopedia. We don't expect anyone to read it from cover to cover. It's too dense. But if someone has a patient with a problem, and the patient's profile fits the profile of the conditions that are described in the supplement, and we pretty well cover all thrombotic conditions, including pregnancy, pediatrics, preoperative care of patients on long-term anticoagulants, then they can initially go to the recommendations, or what many people will do is just go to the recommendations for the condition of interest to them. And then if they want more information, they can then go to the narrative. If they want detailed information, they can go to the tables. And if they want even more information, they can go to the references, to the source references.
So it's a complete compendium.
That's right. And the expectation is very few people would read it from cover to cover.
It seems easy enough to search it if you get it in electronic form as a PDF. You can do a search, which is how I discovered that there were roughly 170 grade 1A recommendations. I just did an enumeration of that.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how many. But I think the other feature of the way it's written, and we've been improving this all along, is each of the recommendations is identified by a figure and a number, say maybe 4.1.3.
And those are like chapter headings.
Yeah, and if you go to the narrative, you'll get to that chapter heading.
Okay.
So each of the recommend, so it's very, very easy for anyone to go back and look at the evidence on which we base a recommendation. And we hope, if we've been successful, it should be possible then for the reader to see why we made the recommendation we made. You know, why it's a 1A, why it's a 2A, why it's a 3, you know, 2C. And it's possible that some people may disagree with our interpretation, but the disagreement's going to be pretty mild. They may say, we think this, based on the evidence chapter, why isn't this a 1B? Why have we made it a 1A? And a lot of our time is spent debating this. There's a, I would say that for the last 6 months, I've been involved daily for at least 3 or 4 hours with this. And this is sort of discussing the issues of, do the recommendations fit the evidence?
And
could I say one other thing?
You certainly may.
The other thing that is different compared, the ACCP were scrupulous in trying to remove bias. So what they did was, we went, there were various layers. The first layer was, each chapter is written and rewritten by the panelists. During this process of writing and rewriting, which is an iterative process, the editors, each of the editors, two editors read every chapter and give feedback to the panelists. And this could go back and forth 3 or 4 times as panelists either accept or reject some of the feedback. And then we end up with a chapter which we are happy with. That is, we, the editors and the panelists. This then goes to the American College of Chess Physicians, and they have a health policy committee. And they ascribe, I think they have at least two of their members read each of the chapters and give feedback back to us and the panelists. And so, you know, and it's at first we were skeptical of the process because we thought it was overly bureaucratic. But in fact, they had some very good ideas. Then it goes to the editor of Chest, Dr. Richard Irwin, who had two people, independent of all of us, read through the whole manuscript, and then they gave feedback back to us. And then once we respond to that, in much the same way as a journal gives feedback back to authors. And we were expected to either accept and change or reject and then provide a reason for rejection.
It sounds like a heroic
undertaking. It was heroic. Now, one may ask whether it was all necessary, but my understanding is that with the tightening up of all sorts of conflict of interest rules and regulations by the health authorities, according to the ACCP, this was necessary. It was tedious. It was onerous and tedious, no question about it.
Yes, and but well worth the effort, and you got it out on schedule.
Yeah, well worth the effort, and I think, you know, we all suffer from author fatigue after a while. You know, when you write something, you like to get it off your plate.
And that's right, just get it out the door.
All the time. But look, in the end, we're very proud of the final product.
And you should be. Could you tell us what you think the most important, or that come to mind to you, what are the two or three most important recommendations that are new in this edition?
And this is off the top of my head. One of the most troublesome ones is the management of prosthetic heart valve in pregnancy. This is troublesome because in the package insert for warfarin, there's a clear statement that warfarin is contraindicated in pregnancy, and the reason for that is that there's good evidence that there is a teratogenic effect and less good evidence that there is a fetopathic effect after the first trimester. But teratogenicity occurs in about, it's hard to, the right figure, probably between about 2 and 5% of fetuses that are exposed to warfarin between 6 and 12 weeks of gestation. Because of this, women who have prosthetic heart valves and who are being treated with oral anticoagulants in North America are prescribed heparin or low molecular weight heparin. There have been a number of reports of valve thrombosis, which is a serious business because the valve can stop operating and the patient dies, of course, from clotted up valve, with heparin and low molecular weight heparin. there was a very small randomized study was stopped because of the risk of thrombosis of low molecular weight heparin in pregnancy that was performed in South Africa. There have been studies in Mexico. And this is a problem that's been recognized by the medical community for a long time, so much so that our recommendations have always been that you should stop warfarin during pregnancy and use either heparin or low molecular weight heparin that do not cross the percent, of course, which require injection and are less convenient. But that's not a big issue if they're effective. But given that there are questions about the effectiveness of heparin and low molecular weight heparin relative to warfarin, which is effective, quite a number of countries, Mexico being one, a number of European countries, United Kingdom being another, prescribe warfarin after the first trimester of pregnancy. And you've got to stop it. You've got to plan the labor and then stop it, the warfarin, a couple of weeks before and use heparin. And up until this time around, we did not succumb to the use of warfarin during pregnancy, despite the fact we knew that other people, people in other countries, were using it. One of the other features of the ACCP, it's become very international now, and that's by design. We have, I think, 20%, I can't remember the exact figure, but I think 20% of all the panelists are now from Europe. We want to get international representation just rather than just a national point of view. And because of that, because of their influence and their correct influence, we now have the possibility that the warfarin be used, of course, during pregnancy, after disclosure and discussion with a patient. That's been tough, I would get emails from cardiologists quite frequently. What should we do? The patient's developed TIA, prosthetic heart valve. We think there might be thrombosis on heparin. Now, when one looks very carefully at the literature on heparin and low molecular weight heparin in patients with the prosthetic heart valve, it's possible that it's not due to the failure of the anticoagulant from the point of view of the mechanism of action, but it could be due to inadequate dosing. And so we've also made recommendations that heparin, low molecular weight heparin, should be very, very carefully monitored, and we've provided target results for the monitoring tests that should be used. So that's been a tough area for us because we haven't, the problem is still unresolved as far as I'm concerned. I think that it's still tough to know what the best thing to do is in someone with a woman who has prosthetic heart valve and is pregnant, particularly the woman, and the fewer and fewer of these now, of course, with the older valves. Most of those women are now past pregnancy age, but because they are more thrombogenic. Yes.
So that was the principle. That was the most contentious recommendation then.
Yes,
that was
the most contentious recommendation, I think.
As I was looking through the executive summary, I saw one recommendation that it's saying that every general hospital should have a strategy to prevent venous thromboembolism. Is that a new recommendation as well?
Yes, it's been something that we've been working on. And the reason for this is, again, it's evidence-based. There is a huge disconnect, as you know, between the results of studies and their results of studies which are clearly positive. And their acceptance or the utilization by the general medical community. And there are also data that show that if there is a proactive approach used by hospitals, such as the hospitals having pre-order sheets, that the compliance to any recommendation is much better. And hospitals, more and more now, hospitals do use predetermined order sheets to improve compliance. So the evidence that we'd get better compliance if hospitals had written policies is good. The evidence that prophylaxis is effective is good. The evidence that all hospitals use prophylaxis is not good. I mean, the evidence is that they don't use prophylaxis when they should. And many of the people who are interviewed about not using prophylaxis do not use prophylaxis, not because they don't believe it works, it just doesn't come to mind. In the hurly-burly of hospital practice, someone's admitted and, you know, there are all sorts of new, weird, wonderful drugs they should be treated with, and they're treated with those, and then prophylaxis is an afterthought because, let's face it, fatal embolism is an uncommon event, but it's a preventable uncommon event. So that was the reason for that. And again, it's done with a lot of forethought because one of the issues, we're very, very conscious of the fact that these guidelines are used for litigation. And we do state in the preamble that, look, there are other ways of interpreting results, and if the recommendation is not a 1A, particularly not a 1A, then physicians should be free to interpret the results the way they see fit. But it makes it's common sense, it seems to me. If people accept that prophylaxis should be used in certain high risk groups, based on the evidence, which I think is very good, and prophylaxis is not being used. And one of the major reasons prophylaxis is not being used is because people forget to use it. Then these pre-order sheets make a lot of sense.
Is there another recommendation that comes to mind that if somebody didn't know, couldn't find their way to this supplement, but they ought to know this one at least? Can you think of one of those?
Yes. I think one of those is in atrial fibrillation. We know that warfarin is highly effective in the prevention of stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation. We also now know that there is one can predict the risk of atrial fibrillation based on certain pretest probability risk factors, and they've been very, very well studied. And on the basis of that, and the basis of the increased bleeding of warfarin compared to aspirin, but the better efficacy of warfarin compared to aspirin, we've stratified our recommendations into those patients with atrial fibrillation in whom we recommend warfarin, and those patients in atrial fibrillation who could either get one or the other, and those patients in atrial fibrillation in whom the risk of warfarin outweighs its benefit, and aspirin is recommended. Despite the very, very good evidence that in high-risk patients, warfarin is effective, it's markedly underutilized. Yeah, markedly underutilized in the community. So if one was to take you can divide the risk of, roughly divide the risk of stroke per year in patients with atrial fibrillation into 1% or less, into 1 to 5%, and into 5 to 10%. And the 5 to 10%, or even 5 to 15% range, with a 66% risk reduction in stroke, there's just no discussion warfarin should be used. But it's used in less than 50% of these patients. And I think it's because physicians don't like using warfarin. It's a scary drug to them.
There was a story this morning that we covered in Physicians First Watch about a drug, rivaroxaban. Yeah. Which is in phase 3 trials. Have you heard about it, and what's your take on this stuff?
I've heard a lot about it, yeah. Well, rivaroxaban is one of a number of oral anticoagulants that's under in advanced stages of clinical development. The two in the most advanced stages are rivaroxaban, which is a 10A inhibitor, and dabigatran, which is a 2A inhibitor. And they're the two targets. They're the two clotting enzymes that are being targeted by these new oral anticoagulants. There are a number of other 10A inhibitors, rivaroxaban-like, but sufficiently different to be separate drugs, that are being developed by other companies. The results with the rivaroxaban to date look very, very good. And I think there's a pretty good chance that warfarin could be replaced by one of these new oral anticoagulants, which has big advantages. We can go into the advantages in a minute. Having said that, everyone thought that this was the case, would be the case with zymalagotran back a couple of years ago, which was an oral thrombin inhibitor or 2A inhibitor, but it was not approved by the FDA because of hepatic toxicity. So the FDA is going to be scrutinizing non-hemorrhagic side effects very, very carefully. To date, it looks good. To date, it looks good. But the only reason I'm a little cautious is it's possible that in phase four studies, problems might arise. I hope they don't. I look forward to the day when we can replace warfarin with a drug which does not require laboratory monitoring because of its more predictable dose response than warfarin. I think when that day comes, the compliance with oral anticoagulants and the appropriate use of oral anticoagulants for certain indications such as atrial fibrillation will increase enormously. It's one of the reasons that physicians are reluctant to use warfarin is the logistics of monitoring is difficult outside of large centers that have anticoagulation clinics or can afford to use computer-assisted programs for dose control.
Well, Dr. Hirsch, you've been doing thrombosis research for a long time now. What advice do you have for newcomers to the field?
Newcomers to thrombosis research?
Yes.
I think that they've got to decide whether they want to be involved in the basic research, discovery research of either drugs for thrombosis or basic mechanisms of thrombosis, or whether they want to be clinical investigators in thrombosis. It's very difficult now to be both, as it is for just any. My advice to anyone who wants to get involved in research is, one, don't get involved unless you've got a passion for it. It's not a hobby, it's a passion. Two, make sure that if you are going to get involved, that your training is adequate. Too many researchers spend a year somewhere and then are recruited somewhere and they no longer do research. And the length of time is somewhat arbitrary, but it's more than 3 years, you know, up to 5 years. And the other thing that's tremendously important is serve under a world-renowned mentor, because you learn a tremendous amount about the culture of research by working with a person who is has a passion, where it's not just a 9-to-5 job, and has a creativity. In addition to hard work and training, research requires creativity. It's a very creative process, that would be my main advice. But that's generic. That's generic advice.
Well, it's sound advice, I'm guessing, and thank you for it. And Dr. Hirsch, Dr. Jack Hirsch, I want to thank you for the time that you've spent with us today.
Pleasure.
Finally, the answer to last week's puzzle from Joe Elia's Archives of Internalized Medicine. The pieces of the puzzle were, a boy takes a spill on his bicycle and a bottle of ink. And the question was, what's the clinical narrative? Well, you were asked to phone your answer in to 617-440-4374. I don't think anybody did, so I get to keep the prize, which, by the way, is an Iggy's bagel. The answer to the puzzle, which happened more than 40 years ago, was when I was a lab technician working up in northern Massachusetts in a town called Methuen at the Bon Secours Hospital in the pathology department. And I was doing scans. I had my own technetium cow in those days. And we did a brain scan on a young boy who'd fallen off his bicycle. And there was a lesion there. Some abnormality was seen on the scan. And the neurosurgeon took a look at it, and I said, look, there's a lesion. And he said, oh, so do you think that's a result of his falling off the bike? And I said, well, it seems to be. And he said, well, Joe, you have to ask why he fell off the bike. He took the kid into the OR, and lo and behold, opened up the cranium, and there was a lesion there for sure, but it was something that was not a tumor, and it wasn't hemorrhage, it was something else. And so he gave me a small sample of it and said, go down to the lab and see if you can figure out what this is. And indeed, when I got down to the lab, I put a smear on a slide and a little bit of ink, and sure enough, there was that encapsulation around it, and it turned out to be Cryptococcus neoformans, which is a fungus, I think. So that's the answer, and maybe it was obvious to you, but it wasn't obvious to any of us 40 years ago. Well, phone in if you'd like to complain about the answer, and if you'd like to complain about anything else, or perhaps even talk about something else. The number is 617-440-4374. And leave your name and number so I can get back to you. Story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. For the Journal Watch podcast, I'm Joe Elia. Thanks for listening.